It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're spending the hour on America's most famous architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. His major works were officially inscribed to the UNESCO World Heritage List earlier this year. You might have heard that. Falling Water, Taliesin, the Guggenheim. That's to name a few of his masterworks in this vast sea of buildings he's designed or worked on over his 91 years. What is it about Frank Lloyd Wright that captivates you? Have you visited Taliesin or other famous structures? Join in with your questions, your perspectives on the works, and the architect himself, 800-642-1234. Paul Hendrickson has written biographies about Ernest Hemingway, famed photographer Marion Post Walcott, and former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. He's been on the faculty of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Pennsylvania for more than 20 years, and his new book is called Plagued by Fire, The Dreams and Furies of Frank Lloyd Wright. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There have been countless words dedicated to this man, his life and his work. They've been chronicled extensively, you know, and he's really admired and despised all at once by the same people sometimes. Why did you think there was more to unearth about Frank Lloyd Wright?
That is an excellent question. I will say you're not the first to have asked it, and maybe the first person who ever asked it was the author asking it of himself. Why? How dare you? Hasn't it all been said? The previous book was about Ernest Hemingway, and that same question obtained. I hope it's just not ego and narcissism of my own. I heard a journalist say once that he was trying, what he hoped to do was to go to where some of the silences are and say something new. I guess that's what I was trying to do, and or at least say something different. Yeah, Kate, there have been 8 or 9, depending on how you count, conventional biographies of this man. I hasten to say this is not a conventional biography. It's not cradle to grave. I don't know how to do those. I don't seem to have the psychic energy to do those. What I do, rather, is pick out selected storytelling pockets in a life and try to make them stand for the oceanic whole of that life. And I try to go very deep into those storytelling pockets so that by the end, and it's a long book, I mean, it's a 600-page book.
you shed some words there.
so that by the end, we have a representative storytelling arc of his life that kind of goes from east to west, meaning when he was born to when he dies in 1959. Born 2 years after the end of the Civil War and dies in 1959, not quite 2 years after the launch of Sputnik. That's 91 years and 10 months on the Earth. That's a lot of life.
One of the things that's so interesting to me is how you chose pictures, just very certain pictures, and then you write about those images at the start of each chapter. You know, that's another vast sea, is all the images out there of Frank Lloyd Wright and his structures. How did you go about deciding which of these photos to use that you would write off of?
Thanks for asking that question. I've done a lot of yakking about the book this fall, and that question hasn't particularly come up. In your introduction, which was 100% correct. I also worked for 30 years as a daily journalist, almost all of it at the Washington Post. In the writing program at University of Pennsylvania, I teach a course called The Hungry Eye, Telling Stories Out of Photographs. The students bring in a family photo, an old family photo, or we look at an iconic photo, and we try to re-enter that photo. We try to walk back into the four walls of that rectangle and thereby find our own storytelling experience, reporting it out. So, to answer your question, I thought that a portal in, a way in that hasn't been done before, going back to the previous question, might be to go very deep for the reader in a few selective images and try to have them suggest their own storytelling universe about the utter richness of this man's life, because, Kate, that's the problem and the bottom line and the undying fascination challenge for a writer. There's so much there. You do, even if you're cradle to grave biographer, you do still in some sense have to be selective.
We're talking with Paul Hendrickson, and his new book on Frank Lloyd Wright is called Plagued by Fire. You can join in. What is it about Wright that you think continues to captivate? Does the lore behind Taliesin still grab you? Do you live in or near a Wright-designed home? What do you think of it? What is it about that structure? Join in, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Paul, in your prologue, you start with the fire at Taliesin on that August day. And, you know, as a reader, I say, uh-oh, here we go. Yeah, and because here in Wisconsin, we know this story, but we think we know the story, but we don't know the story. Tell us about what happened there.
Well, you know, with some humility, I wish to say that some readers and some reviewers have felt that I went into it too much, that the detail is lurid. Gosh, if I was being lured for lurid's sake, then I surely failed. My motivation and goal was, I think I can state it in less than a sentence, which is, how could anyone of us, who are rather human as opposed to the immortal Frank Lloyd Wright, how could anyone survive an event like that and come back from it? And Wright lived another 4.5 decades, and in some sense, some of his greatest works were still ahead of him. It would have crippled me, and I suspect you, creatively and in other ways, for the rest of our lives, and he just, the will to survive. For your listeners who don't instantly know, this event was August 15th, 1914, and a black servant named Julian Carleton, who was supposed to be serving the midday lunch, went inexplicably berserk with a shingling hatchet and ropes of gasoline poured under the door jams. He roasted the place to cinders, and he destroyed 7 out of 9 lives. 4 died, 3 died rather instantly, and the others over the next several days.
And where was Frank Lloyd Wright at this time?
He was not there. He was down in Chicago working on a project called Midway Gardens. He had left a few days earlier, intending to be back on the weekend. If the slayer Julian Carleton had his way, there would have been nothing at all to be back to. He received the news shortly after midday by a frantic call from Wisconsin. He and his second son were working at this entertainment extravaganza complex called Midway Gardens that wasn't finished. They boarded a train, a very slow train, that night back to Wisconsin through Madison and then on to Spring Green. And this is the worst moment of his life. And so the title of the book, Plagued by Fire, yes, Kate, I look at that moment extensively, and I hope not too much, not too graphically. I gave you my motivation. But in fact, and I know you've got to go to breaks, but there were many other fires in his life.
And we're going to get to those fires with Paul Hendrickson, who stays with us. The book is Plagued by Fire. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the life of Frank Lloyd Wright and getting more of the human understanding of who he was. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The new biography is called Plagued by Fire. And here is Frank Lloyd Wright in an NBC interview in 1953, and it takes place in his bedroom at Taliesin. Wright is 85, and he opens up about his early life with journalist Hugh Downs.
In Madison, we were poor. We had no money to send me to a an architectural school, and Madison, our home, had an engineering school, and a very kind dean, Professor Conover, gave me a stipend to work for him, and worked my way through the course at the university, and I worked my way almost through it.
What questions do you have about Frank Lloyd Wright's roots in Wisconsin, his connection to Spring Green, connection to Madison, the UW? Join in 800-642-1234. Author Paul Hendrickson stays with us for the hour. Paul, let us explore the role of fire in Frank's life. One of his apprentices told you that he somehow just attracted fire. Even once, he said, quote, "All my life I have been plagued by fire." So why is this so significant?
You know, that's God's truth and it's God's answer. I as the reporter, was reporting on the phenomenon. I don't know the why of it. Yes, that apprentice who had come as a 18-year-old from Boston, when I spoke to him at Taliesin West in Arizona, a wonderful man. His name is Arnold Roy, and he was past 80, and he hobbled out of a fire-like Arizona noon to talk to me. And we were sitting there at the table at Taliesin West in Arizona, and he said, he leaned across the table and with a kind of urgency said, "Frank Lloyd Wright attracted fire." Pause, beat, almost a gleam in his eye of a certain kind of fire. And then he said, "And I suppose the next question is why?" And Kate, I went all through this book with that question in the back of my head, but not daring to think I could ever answer it. And my goal was not to spreadsheet every fire, but quickly. That fire at Taliesin in 1914, so horrific, in which 7 lives, some of them children, were destroyed. Yes, that's the most iconic and horrific, but fires came down on this man like biblical rain of one degree of destruction or another, from large to small, in 1925, 1927, 1929, 1932, 1937, 1954. Even after he was dead, there were three, it was as if fire would not leave him alone. There were 3 fires in succession at Taliesin West in Arizona. And the why of it, Kate, what I wanted to do was use fire, the idea of fire, both literal and metaphoric, as a framing device that would always be kind of a leitmotif through the story, that would always be kind of licking at the frames and the forms of the story. But I don't, as I say, that's God's truth, that's God's answer. And yet the phenomenon is there, and it's there even in some of the houses he built for his various clients. Those houses too suffered some grisly fire and some grisly death. By no means all of them, but it's just there. And you know, you said, "All my life I've been plagued by fire." Yeah, that gave me the title of the book. He said that in 1954. His last child, Yovana, was getting married in Chicago. Her wedding veil caught fire.
Mm. When his structures caught fire, I mean, he rebuilt Taliesin.
Yeah.
When he would go to rebuild, did he build differently in some way?
Well, that's a beautiful question in a different line of thinking. The will to survive. I mean, the next day, planning, drawing, yes, in some ways trying to build them stronger, to fortify them against nature, but what I am inspired by in this man, who seemed, by the way, one of the things I'm hoping to do in this book is to show more of the humanity of the man. We think of him as the insufferable egotist and the supreme artist. That's true. But there are other things concomitantly true. And I was I refuse to believe that this man ever looked back, that the reason he could survive all this was because of his stainless steel ego and he would just plow forward. I think he was always looking back with a certain haunt, a certain regret, a certain wondering, what did I do here? And that became part of the richness of the subject for me. And if you study closely what he writes in his autobiography, if you study his letters, if you study his Sunday talks, which are off the cuff to his apprentices and fellows, you begin to feel and see what's under the lines. And in the same way the fire became kind of the understructure of the story, the humanity, the H word I call it, that is what I was really trying to get at in this book. But yes, he built them differently.
Talking with Paul Hendrickson, he's the author of the new book on Frank Lloyd Wright. It's called Plagued by Fire. You can join in. There's a line for you. What is your favorite story about Frank Lloyd Wright? What questions do you have about his life, his legacy? Have you made a pilgrimage to see one of his structures? Which one? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, let's talk a little bit about his parents. There's William Carey Wright, his father, and Frank Lloyd Wright wrote about him in his autobiography. He wrote about his father's cruel abandonment, but apparently that wasn't exactly true. What was going on there?
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Why did what you were going to say?
Well, why did Frank Lloyd Wright change things up in how he looked at his life, because some things were clearly untrue?
His autobiography, published in 1932, is one of the great memoirs of the 20th century, but you have to distrust it on every page. He is not unlike a lot of artists, but he is kind of a gold standard prevaricator and a distorter of his own story. We were talking just a second ago about, I think, the greatly underestimated capacity for regret and pain and sorrow. And we think, oh, he never looked back. I think he looked back so much, and speaking of his father, but always looking back surreptitiously while you can forge ahead, because two things can be true at once. Kate, you put your finger right on it. In his book, he told what I could feel is the greatest single lie of his life. And he made it all the more cunning and pernicious by the way he did it, which was by implication and insinuation. He made the world believe, and it fooled a whole first generation of Wright biographers. He made the world believe that his father had abandoned the family and left them financially and emotionally bereft, when the truth was precisely opposite. It was his mother. From his mother, he gets his relentless will, and from his father, he gets so much of his artistic gift. He made the world believe that it was his father's fault, when in fact, it was exactly opposite. His mother was the defendant in the divorce. And the father was a music teacher and a minister, which of course ruined his ministry once he finally had to sue his wife for divorce and leave the family with almost nothing but the clothes on his back, shoved out the door by Anna Lloyd Wright. She was the maternal side of his family, the Lloyd Joneses out in the Wyoming and the Helena Valleys of Wisconsin, out by Spring Green. Why did he take his mother's side? When the family broke up, it was 1885, so he was almost 18. He knew exactly what had happened. Why did he take his mother's side? It's a very, very complicated subject, but he had swung toward his mother and his mother's people. And his father, after that, essentially became a wanderer in America.
And he said in that clip we aired that he grew up poor in Madison, and he attended the UW, but that was for only a short time. Is that right?
Kate, he had a cup of coffee at the, you know, at UW Madison. For the rest of his life, he kept talking about he left a few credits shy because he got bored, and off he went in his senior year to Chicago to make his fame and fortune. He took essentially two courses at the University of Wisconsin. That's only one of his. I'm grinning as I say that prevarication. The parental one, which haunted him, I believe. And I am hardly, though, I need quickly to say this, I am hardly the first biographer that knew this story. Long ago, historians teased out that, in fact, the story was exactly opposite. But what I did try to do is bring more light on the story.
And we have to pause right there with Paul Hendrickson. His new book is Plagued by Fire. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll be right back after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking this hour about a new biography on Frank Lloyd Wright. The interiors of his houses are about many things, biographer Paul Hendrickson writes, but at the center of each one is the intertwined idea of openness and flow. So here's another moment from that NBC interview in 1953 at Taliesin. Journalist Hugh Downs asks, what do you try to put into a house when you design one?
We try to put into that house a sense of unity of the altogether that makes it part of its site. If the thing is successful, the architect's effort, you can't imagine that house anywhere than right where it is.
What are things you've heard about the famous architect that you want to work out? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called Plagued by Fire, and author Paul Hendrickson stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Tony is joining us from Door County. Hi, Tony.
Good morning, everybody. Great show. Thank you for having it. A dear friend of mine who's now passed, Don Erickson, was a student of Frank Lloyd Wright, and he was a Chicago kid that went on a field trip from high school, and it was to be interviewed to get accepted into Spring Green, and to Don's dismay, he didn't make the cut, and he came home that night quite dejected, and he didn't know what to do, and he talked to his dad, and his dad said, well, why don't you call up there and see if you can talk to somebody? So around 10 o'clock at night, Don picked up the phone and called, and somebody answered the phone. He didn't know who it was, and he poured his heart out and said, I just have to be an architect, and I have to go to Spring Green. And the gentleman on the other phone line said, well, I guess you should be an architect. Why don't you come back? And he said, really? And he said, yeah, you're accepted. And he said, well, who are you and who do I talk to? And he said, I'm Mr. Wright.
Wow.
And in that second, Don's life changed forever.
Can I comment on that story?
Go ahead.
Sure.
Thank you for telling it. I wish I would have found you during the research of my book. I think that story would have made it in, if not to the main text, in the back notes, in which I also kind of tell stories that couldn't fit the main frame. You know, there is a moment, Kate and I were talking earlier about, we think of him as this insufferable human being. There's always this other side. And one of the things I was trying to do was make a case, not overstated, but make a case for the other side. You've just told the other side. Kate, the gentleman from Door County maybe would appreciate this as well. I wonder if I could say one other quick thing. I love the fact that you're bringing in this 1953 interview with his gravelly, seductive, musical voice. I know that interview so well. I studied it on the tape. One of the very funny things, it was held out at Taliesin, and they had Hugh Downs, you know, who went on to become Jack Parr's sidekick on The Tonight Show. They had Jack Parr sitting in a lower chair and Wright sitting in a higher chair,
right,
so that he was over top of him. That's very funny. But one other quick little note. you goosebumped me when you said we're going to listen to a 1953 interview. And this, in a way, connects back to the gentleman who just spoke about calling up Frank Lloyd Wright. Kate, I discovered Frank Lloyd Wright myself in 1953. So little loops are connecting here. I grew up in Kankakee, Illinois, where there were two Frank Lloyd Wright houses on the same street I lived in. That was a little town of 25,000 people, 50 miles below Chicago. Under the Christmas tree that year was a J.C. Higgins three-speed bicycle. I was 9 years old, so your listeners can figure out how old I was. When I pedaled down South Harrison Avenue later that spring when it warmed up, there was this incredible Frank Lloyd Wright house staring at me. And in the way, sir, from Door County, that your friend, I mean, the story you told of that apprentice, where he was riveted and went home dejected, something caught my eye in this Frank Lloyd Wright house. It seemed to have just come down from the moon, and there was nothing like it in our town. And I think right then that book found me. And because I'm a slow learner, it only took 6.5 decades for it to loop around and get me as a writing project.
Let's bring in Gary now in Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Yes, good morning. I guess I wanted to touch, but I mean, I would make the pilgrimage to see the house called Falling Water any time anybody wants to go. But it's part of, it always seemed to me that part of the reason he was so combative was because he didn't have academic credentials. You had these people like Le Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe came over from Europe, and they were, you know, products of those big architectural schools over there. Wright didn't have any academic credentials, and it always seemed to me like he was trying to prove to them that he was actually as good or better than they were, even though he didn't have the background that they did.
Gary, thanks.
That's an insightful point, sir. That's an insightful point. And I think you add that to his Napoleonic height. He was a little guy, and this is why his ceilings are always so low. There's an inferiority going on here, and in the fact that he just had almost no higher education whatsoever, I think those things were obtaining, and that he did feel a sense of combativeness. I like your word, yes.
If you're just joining us, we're learning about the life and legacy of Frank Lloyd Wright with Paul Hendrickson. And you can join in. What do you appreciate about the architectural style? Do you see Wisconsin's influence in it? What is your favorite story about Frank Lloyd Wright? And question is it true? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's explore some of his relationships with his colleagues around him, his fellow architects, apprentices. You spend quite a bit of time on Cecil Corwin, one of his earliest Chicago friends. Who was Cecil?
Yeah, I do, and it's early in the book, and there's a 15,000-word chapter entitled The Lost Architect. Cecil Corwin was his first friend when the hayseed from Madison gets on a train and comes to Chicago, the eternal city of the West, to make his fame and fortune. He is the hayseed out of Madison, and he runs into this sophisticated gentleman, 7 years his senior. So it was man-boy, in a sense. Cecil was in his mid-20s. He was 7 years older. He was sophisticated. He was worldly. He was urbane. He knew about the arts. They had an intense attraction, and I am not trying to be intriguing here. I would suggest that when I use that word, that the listeners go look at the book, because I think maybe the most sensitive chapter that I tried to make in the book is this relationship between these two men. But what happened essentially, it's like Mozart and Salieri. I mean, Cecil was a good and more than competent architect, but he was Salieri in the face of Mozart. He began to think of himself as mediocrity in the face of genius. He left They had a beautiful and intense relationship for a half a dozen years in Chicago, and then Cecil went east. And Frank Lloyd Wright has this haunting line in his autobiography: Cecil went east, and God knows why, I never saw him again. They reconnected much at the end, much later, by letter.
By letters, though.
And there's something so poignant and deep and longing in the exchange of letters. So I knew, Kate, I knew I had to get to the bottom of who was Cecil Corwin. And did I get to the bottom? I got edges and pieces of his story because he disappeared. And he ended up working. He was a draftsman in New York, and he had all kinds of talent. And he died in his as an old man in his sister's home in Buffalo. And I went and found his people in New York, in Rochester, New York, and talked to his grandniece and got documents. It's a very poignant story, and again, it speaks to Frank Lloyd Wright's humanity. Frank Lloyd Wright could have written about 1,000 people in his autobiography, and he chose, over the course of 60 pages, to write beautifully and tenderly about Cecil. So I knew it was my mission to try to flesh out for the world who was Cecil, and that has not been done. And that's what I meant at the start of this program when I said I was trying to go to where some of the silences are and perhaps say something different.
Let's bring in Jan now in Luck. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
What's on your mind about Frank Lloyd Wright?
I was raised in Prospect Park, Minnesota, and there was a Frank Lloyd Wright house on Warwick Avenue behind us, the 200 block. I'm not sure if 94 didn't take that house out, I would be sad, and I doubt very seriously they would let them, but who knows. But it was all angles and wood and stone, and it was always mysterious. My friends and I would kind of go over there and walk around, and there never seemed to be anybody that was around there, but the house was beautiful, and it was so much different than the rest of the houses. And my parents made a big deal about the house and talked about it, so that was what, you know, piqued our interest. And I don't know, it was just so much different than the rest of the houses in the neighborhood. It was just beautiful in its angles and its mysteriousness.
Well, Jan, thank you so much for the call. We're talking about Frank Lloyd Wright with Paul Hendrickson. He's helping us explore the man and the life and the people who made the architect's orbit. What questions have lingered on your mind about this architect? Still time for you, your reflections on the homes, the structures, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with biographer Paul Hendrickson here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and the new book on Frank Lloyd Wright, nearly 600 pages, and it showcases his life and the people around him as we dig into his legacy and life work in a 72-year career as an architect, brought to life more than 1,100 designs. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. The book is called Plagued by Fire, and Paul Hendrickson stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Chris is joining us from Cedarburg. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning. I'd like to just share that I grew up over in central Michigan in a town called Midland, and there was a student of Frank Lloyd Wright's who came from the Dow Chemical family named Alden B. Dow. And in our little Midwest town, similar to a Fond du Lac here in Wisconsin, we had pockets of homes that he designed in this style, but he also did a whole subdivision. Imagine 4 or 5 blocks of every single home having large expansive overhangs, carports, heated blacktop driveways, interior walls that were 2-inch thick redwood panels with inlaid leaded glass to catch the light from various angles. Just amazing architecture. As a Midwest kid, I always found the homes to be just fascinating. And it was very unique to see, again, in the Midwest, homes such as this. And it's really quite a treasure to have a whole subdivision full of this style.
Oh, Chris, yeah, I love the word choices you use there.
Yeah.
Paula,
can I comment on that just a second?
Sure.
Chris, yeah, your description was beautiful. The way you described those houses that have that prairie sense, that overhang, replicating. Kate had mentioned houses Wisconsin. These houses are sort of organically trying to grow out of the soil. That is a very famous area of Michigan that is Frank Lloyd Wright inspired in and around Midland. I saw it years ago, but I did not see it on this part of the search. I wonder if I can just take an occasion to say very, very quickly one thing, because I recognize that time will be growing short. You know, I'm not a bona fide architectural historian or critic by any means. I'm a narrative nonfiction writer who gets hooked obsessively into projects. I come out of journalism. So I've written about Robert McNamara, I've written about Ernest Hemingway, and I think I grew into Frank Lloyd Wright from having seen the kind of houses that you described so beautifully, sir. Saw one in 1953 in Kankakee, Illinois. Kate, I never could have completed this journey without the help of so many people right there in Wisconsin who are true architectural historians. Some of them might be listening in, but the cultural historian of Taliesin, Kieran Murphy, there's a woman named Mary Jane Hamilton who's given over 5 decades of her life to understanding the Wright story on both sides of the family. Wright in Madison, you know, there are such Wright treasures. There's the little Jacobs house. It's a Usonian house.
Yeah.
Right on the corner of Birch and Tepfer by the Glenway Golf Course. And a man named Bill Martinelli helped me, and the current proprietor who let me into the house. I'm so grateful to all of these people in Wisconsin. So when I'm hearing these patches of voices around Wisconsin this morning, it makes me humbly feel my indebtedness to them that I can't really pay back.
Let's go to Gail now in Madison. Hi, Gail.
Good morning. I'm a member of First Unitarian Society in Madison, which is one of the iconic buildings.
Yeah.
Oh, you're so lucky.
I have a funny little story about the building, though. The doors are so low. We had people, tall people, banging their heads on the entrance.
Ouch.
And, of course, you can't change a Frank Lloyd Wright building. So we dug out a little of the parking lot to add an little more space under the overhang so people could get in without banging their heads.
And the Unitarian Meeting House is one of the world's most innovative examples of church architecture. Is that right, Paul?
Absolutely. And he built that late in his career. And when I was in Wisconsin promoting the book a month and a half ago and was at the Wisconsin Book Festival, I so wanted to take my spouse out to see that beautiful church. Every time that I was in Madison, which was many times, and it was on the weekend, I made sure I got out to one of the Sunday services at that Unitarian Church. That is one of his great buildings. It's not on the UNESCO World Heritage List like the Jacobs House, the little Usonian, is, and Taliesin out at Spring Green. But ma'am, your place of worship, right out there in Shorewood on the edge of town, is just edge of downtown, is so wonderful. I really, really envy you being able to go to church there on Sundays.
Well, Gail, thank you so much for the call. And Paul, here we have to go quickly, but you kept going back to Midway Gardens in Chicago as you wrote this biography. What was it about those stones and what drew you there?
Yeah, Midway Gardens, for your listeners, got bulldozed over decades and decades ago. There was one little stone that the bulldozers forgot. And almost as a biblical, it's not there now, a supermarket came in last year and took the remaining stone. A cultural historian of Chicago took me there, and almost as a rabbit's foot in my pocket, every time I would land at Midway Airport and get the rental car, either staying around Chicago or driving up to Wisconsin, I would go to that stone and kick away the refuse, the dross, the bubblegum wrappers, and get behind the weeds and see that stone. And why? Yes, it was superstition of me, but it was partly kicking away the refuse and dross of the story so that I could get underneath and hope to find the real man. That near that stone was where Frank Lloyd Wright received the news on August 15th, 1914, that his mistress had just had her head split open and that his house had been roasted to cinders.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Hendrickson is author of the book Plagued by Fire, The Dreams and Furies of Frank Lloyd Wright. All right, so before the hour wraps up, I want to revisit a conversation from earlier this week. On Wednesday, we had this wide-ranging conversation about music that people love to play on jukeboxes. And one of our producers, Keegan Kyle, worked with the company Touch Tunes to bring us exclusive data on popular songs in Wisconsin. And one jukebox hit that we talked about was Africa by Toto. All right, so Keegan, back in the studio to have this update on Africa by Toto and what it has to do with Madison. Take it away.
Hey, Kate. This song has been in my head all week, partially because we talked about it during our conversation. But it's really been puzzling me why Africa by Toto was one of the top-ranked jukebox songs in Wisconsin in 2018. And what made it really unusual was that most top jukebox songs are either popular nationally or across a bunch of cities in Wisconsin, but Africa by Toto was only popular in Madison, Wisconsin.
All right, so what happened?
So after our segment, we got an email from one of our listeners who confirmed that she is a super fan of Toto. And it's not just her, it's a group of bicyclists who go around very typically, and kind of their routine is to stop at bars and restaurants. And she says that they have a tradition of whenever Africa by Toto is played on a jukebox, everyone has to take a shot. So, of course, they have played this song hundreds of times. And she claims that they are responsible for Africa by Toto being a huge hit in Madison.
Well, you know, it's always nice at the end of the week to solve one tiny mystery. And if this is going to be the mystery that we're solving this week, so be it.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, shout out to your group. What's the name of her bike group?
Bikes, Butts, and Beers.
Love it. Had to get that name in there. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network.
Hurry, boy, she's waiting.